Hello, folks. Welcome to the premium podcast series from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I have a very special guest for you today. I know normally I start off these podcasts by talking quite a bit about the biographies, the history, the experience, the expertise of the person who I will be interviewing. This time, though, it seemed more appropriate for me to let the biography of our guest spin out over the course of the interview. Our guest today is Ron DeLord. You may have heard Ron's name if you haven't, or even if you have. Ron is one of the deans of police union labor work in this country. Ron comes to us from Texas, a state which, as you'll hear Ron describe, has a very, very unusual and fractured collective bargaining system. Ron is the historian of the police union movement. He's written books about the topic. He knows more about the history of police unions than any individual that I have run into in my life. He's a wealth of information, a wealth of stories. We're going to talk about something that is very, very serious. We'll start off a little bit discussing the development of police unions in Texas over the 1970s and 1980s, but then we'll turn to the main topic of the interview, and the main topic is, what's the future of police unions in this country? There's so much controversy swirling around in the public discussion about police, about not only police procedures, but also the power and even the very appropriateness of the existence of police unions. You'll hear Ron give a prescription as to how it is he thinks police unions can best navigate the rocky shoals that are ahead. It is a prescription that may be a little bit difficult for some people to hear, but it is a prescription that you definitely need to consider. So with that, I give you Ron DeLord. Ron, welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm glad to be here from the Republic of Texas. Beautiful day.
The fine Republic of Texas. Are there any other republics among our states?
Well, California has it on their flag, but they never actually. There were a number of people that tried to form them, but we're the only state that actually became a nation. It has its own currency, military, yeah.
I thought you guys still were your own nation. Did I miss something somewhere?
Well, it feels like it. I don't know if what it is about the culture of Texas, but there is a fierce independence and a sense of that we're better than the other states, I guess, that this is the promised land. And it just kind of stayed in the psyche. You don't run into people going, hey, you know, look at all the history in Iowa. There's not. I mean, shows, the West, everything happened in Texas. And it's just one of those states that if you're from Texas, you tell people, and if you're not, you just keep quiet.
Okay, I'll keep quiet. I'm from the anti-Texas. I grew up in Southern California. So, Ron, I want to talk a little bit about your career before we get into the subject of the podcast, because I think your background is really important in establishing how it is you came to have the views you have now about the role of police unions in kind of our larger culture. You started off your career as a police officer, right?
That's right. I was in college at Lamar University in Beaumont, and a friend of mine in a fraternity got on the police department. And I had been looking at the police, and I can't tell you why, because when I was as early as 19, Houston would hire you, and I started looking at it. My dad talked me out of it. And when I turned 21, on the day I turned 21, Beaumont police were hiring. I just went down there and joined in 1969 and just stayed in that now for approaching 51 years in the police world. So
how long
I came
did you
from a labor background. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just going to say, how long did you stay with Beaumont?
Not very long. I was near the end of college. So I was there just short of 3 years, but I was already on the union board and was starting to get activist. My dad was a union president. All of my family were in the unions. So I came up in a very union area of Texas. So I came with a lot of, at least some labor concepts. And so, but I graduated from college and I wanted to get out of Beaumont, Port Arthur. And I went to Mesquite, Texas, of all places, which at the time was hiring college graduates, had a 10-hour day, 4-day week, and take home cars. And I wanted to work on a PhD. I had decided not to go to law school. So that's how I migrated. And I stayed there 6 years. So full-time policing about 8 years, 1 year off to form cleat. So full-time about 9 years.
Now, help us out. I know we can all find a map and look at it. Where is Mesquite?
It's on the east side of Dallas. It's one of those suburbs that just ring the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And at the time, it was very progressive for the state. And so I looked at it. I looked at Dallas, Austin. And at the time, I wasn't intending to stay in policing. My interest was I liked it, but I wanted to go further into it, either as an attorney or get a PhD and teach criminal justice. So, but when I got to Mesquite, I got active again. I was elected president of the association. I went out and got involved in a pay raise referendum and then a collective bargaining referendum. So by the time I left Mesquite, I was spending a lot of my time, you know, on the local labor end, trying to improve the wages and working conditions in Mesquite.
A couple of foundational questions for you. First of all, you mentioned that in the process you founded CLEAT, Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas. Tell us about how CLEAT got founded. It's one of the still one of the major law enforcement associations in the country, and the founding story isn't well known outside of Texas.
Sure. At the time, the Texas Municipal Police Association, which still exists today, and say they're bigger than CLEAT, they may be, I don't know. But at the time, they were a large fraternal group of municipal-only police. There were no deputies organized or just special districts, all of that. It's just some large municipalities had very fraternal police association. So I wanted TMPA to become more labor-oriented. In 1973, they passed a bargaining law in Texas. You had to have a referendum to get it. But a lot of cities were winning bargaining elections, and we had come close in Mesquite to winning. And I wanted TMPA to become a labor union, you know, not just a fraternal group. So John Burpo, who came down to, was hired to represent a couple of large locals in bargaining out of Illinois, was a labor lawyer with a background. And he said, well, if they won't do it, why don't we just form our own union? So we had a convention in 1976, a large group of us, the bargaining groups, which was San Antonio, Corpus, El Paso, had bargaining in Fort Worth, who didn't have it but wanted it, all went to TMPA, and they voted not to do it. They didn't want to raise their dues. They didn't want to be a union. We walked out of there, chartered CLEAT, and with about 400 people to start out, maybe 1,000 by the end of the year, we just said, let's just do our own union. Let's be a labor union and bring to Texas something that nobody has. And I'll add a caveat. At the time, the International Brotherhood of Police Officers, which is out of Boston, is part of NAGE, National Association of Government Employees. They had come to Texas in this period of 74, 75, 76, and had organized a number of police departments with bargaining, Beaumont, Port Arthur, I think Laredo, several others. So we said, look, we're either going to sit around and let this outside union come down here and pick up these and split us, or we're going to form our own union. And I went to the chief and said, I want to take a year off of work. And I only made $1,000 a month. And I said, I'm going to take the next year off. I'm going to try to see if I can form a statewide union. And he was a nice guy. And he just said, fine, take off. So I went, I took an unpaid leave from the police department and spent all of 77 organizing, driving to my car, staying at friends' houses. They had no money. I got paid $6,000. for the year. But in February of 78, the chief said, look, you got to come back to work. You can't be gone forever. It's a small police department. And I said, chief, once you drive the car, you never want to get in the back seat again. And I said, I quit, and I'll just take my chances building this union.
And you became then, or did you become then the first president of CLEAT?
Yeah, we had an interim, you know, when we incorporated, Jerry Clancy out of San Antonio was the interim. But they kind of, all of that kind of fell apart. And I became the president from this small group. And I stayed president. I was elected every 3 years for 10 years. So I was president 30 years. And then I decided it's not healthy. I wasn't a policeman anymore. I worked full-time for the union, but I was the elected president. And I decided not to run again. I became executive director for a couple of years and then decided I don't want to run it. I really want to bargain. I want to think and write about policing and what the future holds. And so, but I stayed there 36 and a half years. I officially left in July of 2013.
And a little bit more about background. Texas
sure.
is very unusual. I think of it as being sui generis, as a matter of fact, in terms of its approach to collective
yeah.
bargaining for police and sheriff's unions. Describe for unravel that mystery that is this relationship between civil service and local elections and collective
yeah.
bargaining and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's really complicated. Most states adopt a labor law. They get a labor board, and then the labor board manages it. But that isn't the case in Texas. We got municipal civil service in 1947, but you had to have an election to get it. So there's 20 and only municipal police. So thousands of police departments today, maybe 70 departments covered by the State Civil Service Act. And then in 1973, they passed the Collective Bargaining Act, modeled off the National Labor Relations Act, not off of municipal bargaining. But you had that election to get it. And there's about 40 cities, mostly South Texas, labor areas, high Hispanic areas, blue collar, they've got bargaining, but only about 40 out of 2,700 departments.
Now, Ron, let me stop you for a moment, because
yeah.
when you say civil service, you mean something different than, for example, a civil service board that just sets hiring standards and makes disciplinary decisions and the like. Civil service in Texas means and meant something to do with bargaining as well, didn't it?
No, it doesn't. Not at the time. At the time, it's a statewide set of rules. Houston's kind of carved out their own. It sets the hiring discipline. And back in the 80s, I got lobbied and got binding arbitration for discipline put in the state law. So if you're in what's called Chapter 143 city, you have binding arbitration for your discipline. There's no bargaining built into that. Now, over the years, we started, the sheriffs, bigger sheriff's departments got some civil service of their own. Then we created what's called meet and confer. Now, our bargaining law, without getting too wasting time, is really a meet and confer law because the impasse procedures don't work. So we then passed a meet and confer law that says if you have civil service, you can mutually agree to bargain and have a contract. So we have another 40 or 50 groups that never had collective bargaining. They're not required to have an election. Like Mesquite, the city and the union just agreed, hey, let's bargain, and they can bargain a contract. It's still binding. So Fort Worth, Houston, Austin police all have just meet and confer. But structurally, it's the same. So today, there's maybe 70, 80 departments, including some sheriff's departments, that have what I would call bargaining or meet and confer rights, have a contract. But the vast majority, numerically, of the 2,700 departments, all at will. At will. So numerically, the number of police, if you take all the police from 100,000 police, a lot of them are covered by either civil service or a contract. But all the small agencies, 250-something sheriff's departments, constables, all at will. Every 4 years, thousands of them get fired when the new boss comes in.
Well, describe that process, because in many states, what you've just talked about, a new boss coming in every 4 years and everybody gets fired, that's utterly foreign to them.
No, and it is typical in the South, excluding Florida. But if you take the old South, Virginia, places that have prohibitions against bargaining, it's a horrible system. And we have slowly cleaned it up a little bit, even with a conservative legislature. But I have many, many friends spend their whole lives, 20, 30 years working. I know one here where I live was the assistant chief deputy, number two to the sheriff. The sheriff retires, new sheriff comes in, they fine. They have no civil service. In Texas, there's no covenant of good faith and fair dealing like you have in many states like California. You can fire you for anything except a violation of the law reporting. That's it. So you don't need any reason. And I've worked with sheriff's departments where at least half the department were just let go, just fired, no matter where they're at in their career. They didn't do anything wrong. They weren't even political. It's a horrible system, but sheriffs are extremely powerful in Texas, and that system is not going to change. And constables, which is an odd situation that we have in Texas, where every county, almost every county, has to have four constables, up to eight constables. And in Houston and the big counties, they can have hundreds and hundreds of deputies doing basically the same work as the sheriff. In these districts, it's not just serving civil process anymore. They got motorcycle units, radar guns. They're out there with, and look like another police force. So we have multiple layers of policing in Texas that you don't have in many places.
All right. Now, a little bit more background, this personal to you. As time goes by from 1977 on forward, you end up with both a master's degree in police science and administration, and you end up getting your JD, your Doctor of Jurisprudence degree, as a lawyer. What led you down those two paths?
Well, like I said earlier, I started out wanting to be a lawyer. And I went to college. I was going to be a lawyer. I wanted, I don't know. Nobody in my family had ever graduated from college. But I wanted to be a lawyer. That was what I wanted. But once I got on the police department and I finished and then went up to Mesquite and started working on my master's, I thought, I don't want to do that. I'm going to get a PhD. But once I got going in Cleve, I realized I had an opportunity. So myself and two other police officers, we all decided to go to law school in Houston, the South Texas College of Law. So for a while, one of us stayed together all the way to the end. And I just drove from my house near Austin down to Houston to class. And I got out in 3 years with my class. I went year-round. And, you know, you steal time from your family. You steal time from work to get it. But I was driven. I wanted to be a lawyer. But I didn't really want to practice law. I felt like for me to have a voice in dealing with all these managers, mayors, city attorneys, I had to be on the same level with them. I've told everybody, you don't need to be a lawyer to be a contract negotiator. The fire uses few lawyers. The police tend to. You don't have to be. But it made me show up at the table with a different type of respect that I wouldn't have had just being Ron DeLord, ex-cop. You know, so that I was driven to do it. And I got it. I finished in 86 when I was 38 years old. And I'm glad I did, although I never really practiced law except for bargaining, you know, contracts.
Also, Ron, you're one of the few people in our business, and by our business, I'm talking about very generally labor representatives / lawyers who've specialized in representing public safety organizations over their careers. You're one of the few who's actually written a book, and you've written many more than just simply a book. I want to start with a couple of books that I found absolutely fascinating. What brought you to write books about lynching in Texas?
Well, my side my side gig or whatever you call side job is I became over the years when you're, you know, you run a police union on a statewide level. And then I had friends that were killed while I was a policeman, funerals I attended. And just over the years, seeing this, I decided that I would start working on the police memorial. And so I became kind of the guy overseeing all the research and doing the research with a group of other retired officers. And we had accumulated so much material because in many of these cases, the people that killed the police, at least in the early days, the crowds would lynch them. So my writing partner, who had never been a policeman, but was a historian, we said, you know, we've got a lot of data, and we ought to sit down and figure out, can we identify and prove what's true or not true? So over 4 years, we started going back and researching every vigilante action, lynching, and legal hanging from the start of, before the Republic, back 1819, all the way up to when they quit hanging people in public in 1923. So that was kind of accumulation of data from two books that we wrote about lawmen, both good and bad. And so I just felt that story was, and I know you had two older white men writing this story, but it was one of those stories that need to be told. Texas is a very, very violent state and has a long history of violence. Now, I don't mean everyone's bad, but if you look at the history, the battles with the Native Americans, the fight with civil rights, lynching, and we felt those stories need to be told. And we got a lot of positive things from African-American museums, family members who didn't know the history, you know. And so that was it. It was just one of those, it's a side deal that I'm fascinated by the history of the state, policing, criminal justice. That's kind of what that came about.
And I think your book on the history of the police union movement in this country, actually, I said that in the singular, there's more than one. I think those are essential resources that anybody who's involved on either side of the management or labor in police unions ought to be reading. Why'd you put those books together?
Yeah. Well, it started when I did my master's thesis, which I fiddled around on for 10 years, but I finished it just before I went to law school. I wrote a little history of what I knew at the time. And then in about 1996, Charles Thomas Publishers contacted John Burpo, who had written an earlier labor book back in the 60s for them, and said, you guys out here, would y'all be willing to write a book about labor unions in the United States? So I kind of added that, updated it, and we took our seminars that we had been doing about politics and confrontation, the police, and we said, let's put that in a book. And that led to, 10 years later, another book, and 10 years later, the latest book that Ron Yark and I wrote. So that kind of came about of us saying, hey, what are we learning out here? What are we hearing? And in each book, our thought processes have changed. And what I believed then, I still believe. Then the question is it applicable today, and will it work? And if it doesn't work, then you got to change the way you do it.
Now, am I correct in saying that when you started, particularly 1970s, 1980s, and the police union movement, the police union movement in Texas was a very rough and tumble affair from a political perspective. Is that right?
Well, I was taken. I wasn't arrested, but I was removed from a number of police departments when they found I was in the building. It was hardball all the way. And see, but we came in, when I started, what was alien to Texas was the police having a voice. There were no political endorsements. There was no fighting back and putting up billboards and going after people. And John Burpo and I both believed in Saul Alinsky, and that's another story. So we decided this is a revolution. We are not going to get these chiefs and many of these big associations unless we come in hardball. And so we did. We're the first union in the 80s to endorse and come out against the governor. It was Bill Clements, a big Republican, and we had cops against Clements. The chiefs held a press conference and attacked us for being involved in politics. TMPA, which was more conservative at the time, held a press conference and said that policemen were insulted that we were endorsing a candidate. Now, today, they all do. But at the time, it was radical. It was radical to do radio spots. It was radical to put up billboards. So we just decided they're going to, and they would fire. I mean, we read for many, many police officers who helped try to help us organize got terminated. And we just decided we were going to change that system. And that's what we put the binding arbitration into the Civil Service Act to keep these chiefs and sheriffs from just firing everybody. So, yes, I came with a Saul Alinsky hard attack, hard ball, no surrender, no mercy, because that's what we had to do to build it. We couldn't have built it the way it was sitting then. It might have slowly evolved. It would have been more fraternal. But at the time, that's what we had to do. We were defended officers. At the time, I'll just say that, at the time, most associations, they did not represent policemen who got in trouble. They might have a vote. They might give you some money. But you got fired. You got fired. You're on your own. And when we started CLEAT, our position was, we will represent you. If 100% of the department quits because we represent you, we will represent you anyway. Because when you're down and out and you're in trouble, you've got to have a friend. And you paid for us to be that friend for you. And that was so alien to Texas. People got up and walked out of meetings when I told them that. But then they had evolved, you see. Anyway, that's kind of was an approach we took.
Now, you mentioned a name, Ron, and I'm not sure all of our listeners will be familiar with him. Saul Alinsky. Tell us just a little bit about Saul Alinsky, the Industrial Areas Foundation, and why why Saul Alinsky's works and writings and more so his actions influenced you.
I would tell people today, get Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. It's a little paperback. The principles that he has in there about organizing a group to build power are as relevant today as they were in the 1930s. He was a PhD criminologist who got involved in Chicago with helping poor people organize, unions, meatpacking plants, tenants. He was a socialist who wanted to help. So his deal was, you've got to build an organization if you want power, because power doesn't concede anything. So one of the famous deals of his was the people living in these housing projects full of roaches. They couldn't get the housing authority. Actually, a bunch of rich people appointed, and they kept going down there begging people. So finally he came with a group, and they brought like a million cockroaches in jars. And when they refused to fumigate the apartment, they released the cockroaches in the building. So those type of going outside your comfort level, going outside the comfort level of who you're battling with, what you need to do to get a group to stay together and stay focused, those principles apply to any organization that wants power. There's a big difference when you go to a city council or a commissioner's court and they don't show you respect. Then you have to get that respect, because all the things that need to be done have to be done by mutual respect. And if one side or the other doesn't respect them, then there has to be enough confrontation to readjust the power grid so that people can hear each other. You see, that lady with the shopping cart who goes to the back mic and talks, they're not listening to her. You show up with 1,000 members, you show up with political action money, you show up with willingness to run a candidate against them, they're going to at least hear you. But there has to be that respect. And so all confrontation is about realigning the power grid so you can hear each other.
And for our listeners, we're going to post links on our website for not only Ron's books, but also we'll post a link to Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, which I by the way, completely agree with Ron. It is an excellent book. It's a very short book. It's an easy read, but an excellent book on what you need to do to transform your organization into an effective and more powerful one. So, Ron, now let's get to the present. You and I have talked somewhat over the years. From time to time, we've run into each other in different places. But we started a conversation in earnest in really October or November. This was an electronic conversation, emails we exchanged. And we were talking back and forth about the we eventually focused on the November 2019 elections, and we were discussing ballot measures that dealt with police oversight measures. We were focused, we talked a lot about two of them. One of them that that covered the New York Police Department, and another that covered the Rochester Police Department. And you made the observation pretty much right off the bat in this conversation that I found fascinating and then wasn't able to contradict you, that you could not recall a ballot measure on police accountability that had actually failed. Why'd you make that observation? What was the point you were trying to make there?
Well, I learned a lot of lessons. I look at everything from 30,000 feet. I'm not a policeman anymore. I'm not running a union anymore. So I have the emeritus position of just observing. And in the round of bargaining that we had in Austin in 2017 and 2018, where we had a head-up confrontation with the reform activists, how I dealt with it the first round, and they got the council to vote the contract down, not approve it, after we negotiated. And what we did in the next year, I learned a lot of lessons. And so I knew then, and we knew, we did not want that on the ballot. And so I just switched gears, and I started looking at all of these, and I said, if they make it to the ballot, they're going to pass it no matter what it says, because they've got a message that is simple and fits on a bumper sticker, and the police unions have no message. You see, you look at Rochester, Nashville, Oakland, name any place where they've had a police reform deal. They have just, the reformists have won hands down. Now, how is that? Because there's only, if you took all the Black Lives Matter, every reformist group, even in Austin, they're not even 0.5% of the population. But their message is resonating with the public. And you would look at Rochester. Think Rochester. That's not a liberal hotbed of activism. And I know Mike Mazzeo, he's one of the great union presidents in the United States. They couldn't stop it. And so in Austin, our position and what I've looked at is you've got a series of things. What Brian Marble did in Porac in California with the unnecessary force, brilliant. They slowed it down. They stopped it. They worked out a deal. The activists got a bill. They got a law they could live with. In these other places, once it gets to the point that it's on the ballot, they have a very simple message, and that message is transparency plus accountability equals trust. The police unions have no answer to that. Because, see, they've lost sight that people know the risk. We risk our lives. We have a dangerous job. That's not selling anymore. People know that you have a dangerous job. 85% of the public in any poll will support the police. But what they don't like is the optics. And what they don't like is that they feel that the police in certain situations, that was not an acceptable use of force. See? So the police try to argue all of these things that the public already knows. But what they do want is they want the police to be transparent and accountable so that there's trust. And the police have not found a way to have a message that would override that vote. You look at New York City, look at Nashville. I mean, that's a progressive town. That's not a liberal hotbed. And a handful of people put that on the ballot. The union spent a fortune. It couldn't stop it. Because we have not looked at what we need to be doing on our end in this debate.
Let's talk about some of these ballot measures, and let's start with Rochester. I found the Rochester election particularly telling because they already had police oversight in place. They already had an advisory board. And what they ended up with, and this was a huge margin of victory for the activists, it was a 75 to 25 margin. They ended up with a board that is not going to be advisory anymore. It's going to make decisions. It will be the ultimate disciplinary decision maker, and it will be the investigative board. That's pretty. That is a pretty striking change. And then when we get to New York, and I'll turn it over to you for Nashville in just a moment, Ron. But when we get to New York, we have another 75 to 25 margin. This is an election where there was no spending, no appreciable spending by the proponents of the reform. The Police Benevolent Association in New York spent, it was reported at $157,000, may well have been much more. And these are pretty big changes for New York, not huge, not Rochester-level changes, in that you're not going to have what's known as the Civilian Complaint Review Board with disciplinary authority in New York, but it beefs up the power of the CCRB and will allow the city council to appoint members to the CCRB. That's going to guarantee, I think, a much more activist CCRB than in the past. So we have these two New York elections, 75-25 margins, and tell us what happened in Nashville.
Well, they, I'm not an expert on it, but they had a series of efforts to reform, and in return, they eventually, the activists got it on the ballot. They got a new 11-member panel. They got investigative and compulsory powers to review arrests and actions. Passed 59-41, the Nashville FOP outspent the people supporting the ballot 30-1. So no amount of money, is going to stop it. And I will tell you this, we'll stop and let's identify where you can see their playbook. It's not a mystery. Each of these elections have one or more of the components. You can go to Campaign Zero on the internet. It has a list of things, how to oppose union contracts, but in it, it has a list of goals. In Austin, they took that goal, they brought it to the city and said, here's what we want. We want this independent board, we want the right to investigate, we want the right to compel testimony, we want subpoena power, and so about eight things. Well, that's the same eight things as one way or the other in all the other elections, you see. So we know what they want, and they want really is to run the police department, and they want to strip the chief of that authority. Now, they don't get that in every place, so they modify it. But once they get a board, and here in Austin, they had a review board that had been in place 20 years. They had access to materials. They could set. They couldn't be in the room on an internal affairs investigation, but they could be in an outer room and watch and hear it. I mean, they had a lot of rights, but they wanted more. So now they've got, they don't have the subpoena power, but they have a full-time police oversight monitor. They have a new board being selected. They've got more rights to access to materials, training, and make recommendations. So, but that's a deal we worked out with them to get them not to put it on the ballot.
I want to summarize a couple of other recent ballot measures that dealt with police accountability, and one of the two I was pretty intimately involved with. The one I wasn't involved with was 2016. We saw one in Oakland that passed by an 83-17 margin, gave the police commission the authority to investigate officers and actually write new police policies and hire the police chief. And then I think the big one, which was quite an extended tale, and this is the one I did have some input into, was what was known as Initiative 940 for the entire state of Washington in 2018. Washington had an unusual criminal statute dealing with deadly force. It was part of the homicide statutes. Mm-hmm. And in Washington, this statute required that prosecutors prove not only all the other elements of a homicide, but also malice in order to prosecute mm-hmm. a police officer. And there'd never been a prosecution of a police officer for the use of deadly force in Washington. That became the centerpiece of Initiative 940, mm-hmm. was changing that use of force standard. But the activist groups kind of in the While You're Up department wrote a sweeping ballot measure that dealt with everything from whether officers have to provide immediate first aid at the scene of a shooting, even at the risk of their own lives, to mandatory training programs and mental health training for officers, de-escalation training, independent investigations of the use of force, and more, many, many more. This was one where the spending was different than in many of these elections. The proponents, led by some Amazon.com billionaires or millionaires, outspent police groups. The proponents, it was a group that went by the name of De-Escalate Washington, spent over $3 million. The opponents, police unions, could only come up with $280,000, and it passed by a 60-40 margin. We're seeing these things, these types of ballot measures, we're seeing them all over the country now.
Yes. And they could, and I was watching the Washington State deal. It wouldn't have mattered. You could have reversed the spending, it would have still passed. You got this problem in Washington State, you only got one big union, Seattle, and I think what they put $100,000 in the pot. The police chiefs and sheriffs aren't going to put any money in. If you're going to deal with reform, it's really between the unions and the activists. Forget the chiefs, sheriffs, no one cares what they think, okay? They're not going to sway anything. So, but in that state, you got only a couple unions. The rest of the state, they're pretty small. They couldn't play the game. You go to New York City, the unions are huge, but the market is massive, you see? So in California, had that bill passed the first round in PORAC, not got it killed there in the whatever the last days of the session, it came back the next session. That ballot, had that gone to an election, it would have passed in California too. So in those states, you got rich people that are underwrited, yeah.
And what would have passed in California had not the compromise bill been agreed to later on is a bill that would have utterly upended Graham versus Connor. That basic standard for the use of deadly force, and would have done exactly what the Supreme Court said you shouldn't do in Graham, which is to look back at not from the perspective of the officer, but look back from the perspective of hindsight. And so the compromise, you mentioned Brian Marble, who's the longtime president of San Diego and now the president of PORAC. Yeah. The compromise that PORAC was able to engineer there actually wrote Graham versus Connor into the statutory system in California. But that was a very close call and could have gone the other way. Now, while all this has been
very
happening,
smart.
And while all this has been happening, Ron, we've seen this trend towards the election of progressive prosecutors. You have at least one there in Texas, in Harris County. But we see progressive prosecutors all over the place. Denver has one. Kim Fox in Chicago, who is now up for re-election. Perhaps most publicly, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. But there's one in Boston and in St. Louis. And then the election that I do want your views on, the 2019 election of Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. This is an election that I think is pretty fascinating. Boudin is the son of two self-described radicals who killed two police officers and a security guard in a Brinks armored car robbery. one of his parents is likely never going to get out of jail after being convicted. There were a multitude of candidates in the election, and the police unions gathered a fair amount of money. The police groups amassed $700,000, some of which came from out of states. Seattle Police Guild gave some money. Portland Police Association gave money.
Yeah.
Some of it came from other jurisdictions in the state. Los Angeles Police Protective League reported to have contributed $150,000 in that election. And Boudin was, I mean, he wore his platform on his shirt. You know, he said, you know, I'm going to basically not prosecute what I think of as lower level crimes, what he describes as quality of life crimes. And those are crimes like prostitution and camping on the streets, public urination. And he won. And he has since said he's going to do that in keep all of his campaign promises, and he is not going to be prosecuting these lower-level quality-of-life crimes. And now the police union in San Francisco has to deal with him in some fashion. What are your thoughts on that particular election?
Well, and I knew before this podcast is over, I'll aggravate some of the police and the police unions, but that's not necessarily my intent. You cannot stop an idea whose time has come, okay? Particularly in our large urban cities. Is there going to be less homelessness, less mental illness, less drug addiction, less poverty? All of the ills of society come into these large urban cities, and that's where you're seeing this. Now, the people that live there, and the idea in these areas is, we don't want the police dealing with these things. We don't want these things criminalized. So now I'll say what I've been saying, but people don't like to hear it. It is not the role of the police to decide how they're going to police. That is decided by elected officials and the voters and citizens who live there. Now, we saw that recently with this open letting everybody camp on the streets in Austin. Well, it backed up enough that now the city's, you know, going to fix it. But it's okay for the police and union to tell you what they think is going to happen if you do that. But the majority of people in these large urban markets do not want all these resources, this rotating, putting poor people, mostly mentally ill, drug addicted, into jail. Now, here's the antidote. What I think the police unions have failed to do is to shift that problem from themselves to the elected officials and the public to pay for the social programs that should be handling these things before it reaches the police. And you're starting to see this come up. When cities are starting now to go in, hire social work experts, hire people to work with the police to go in and deal with these deals, you see. So the San Francisco unions, of course, it's a unique city. They could have spent $50 million, but the public, now, if the police are right and the quality of life goes down, which it will, then it's up to the public to fix that, you see. So the police wanted to tell everybody, this is how we want to police. It's not their job. They can speak. They can try to influence it, but it's not their job to do that. You know, in the early days, policemen did whatever they wanted. But over time, reform, changes, updates, modern. The police today are not like the police when I started half a century ago. Totally different, the way they view their work. So you're going to continue to have these DAs, and you're going to have this continuing evolution of what the public wants its police to be doing with their time and the amount of money they're paying them. And there's a... the union ought to be saying, you need to be hiring the social workers. You need to be providing the facilities for the homeless. We have a very difficult system in Texas. Families, time after time, cannot get their loved ones into a mental health facility. It's almost impossible. And then the police deal with it. It turns out tragic. They end up injuring or killing somebody, or they kill the police. That should have been fixed on the front end. And I would tell the unions, I'd be spending $700,000 to put the pressure on them that the council ought to act and accept responsibility for this thing. Don't blame the police that we had to go in and clean it up because you didn't have a social network to deal with it.
So, Ron, while all this has been going on, the police reform measures, the progressive prosecutors, there have been some striking developments that you might consider to be on the other side mm-hmm. of the balance sheet. We've seen mm-hmm. some attempted cutbacks in collective bargaining. It was successful, of course, in Wisconsin, successful in Iowa. But in neither of those states did the voters actually get a say. The two occasions when voters have had a say on collective bargaining cutbacks, one in Ohio, when John Kasich became governor there in Ohio, and another in Anchorage, which bargains under a local ordinance and woke up one Wednesday morning to find a Tea Party majority on the city council that completely eviscerated the collective bargaining law. Both of those got to the public, and the public in campaigns led by police supported collective bargaining. You also have a few tax measures around the country. The one I thought was really striking was in St. Louis, where St. Louis voters approved a tax measure that resulted in a 30% raise for St. Louis police officers. So what I'd like you to do, Ron, if you're willing to take on this challenge, is knit all of this stuff together for us, the progressive prosecutors, the police accountability, the approval ratings in the polls that you cited, the 80-85% approval ratings, the no cutbacks on collective bargaining, the tax measures. Put this all together for us.
Yeah. Well, I think that we take a look at this. I go back to the beginning. I'm looking at this from 30,000 feet. If you're down there in the rank and file, members are screaming and you're working, and you don't always stop to think about it. This is what I see happening. The public can separate that they support the police, but not right or wrong. That they support the police. But then they also understand to get the type of police you're going to need in the future to do the type of work you want them to do, where it's a lots of restraint and de-escalation and far more social aspect, and be highly trained, they're going to pay for it. We're getting raises today in Texas, and getting our major city police are making more money than I ever dreamed they would make. We just got huge raises in Dallas. We're getting more raises coming up in Fort Worth, Austin, one of the highest paid in the country. The public is willing to pay that money. And we're not having as much pushback over the pensions that we used to have for a while. Even in places where the pension may be in trouble, the public is supporting that the police deserve those things. What is changing is this vision by the public of what they think the police ought to be doing. They know you have the right to use lethal force. What we're judging is, was that acceptable? Does that meet a public standard of whether the police in this situation should or should not have taken someone alive? And we see these every day. And some of them, I know policemen privately will tell you that was poorly handled or situational awareness was bad. The officers made mistakes. So I think we have this evolving change. And I think the unions have gotten in themselves into a trench mentality that they don't need to be in. There is no war on the police. I know everybody believes there is. There is no war on the police. There is a small group of people who want the world to change the way they want it. There's a lot of people, the majority of people, that are watching, and they want good policing. They want the police to act right. They're willing to pay a top dollar. But for that dollar, they expect top performance from you. And so there's no war on you. And so let's stop this message mentality. And I try to explain, not every activist is your enemy. There are truly people who are activists who really want a better police force, the way they see it. there are people that we cannot deal with. They're anarchists. They hate the police. Well, I don't worry about those people. But we have to have the message, quit fighting about training. Quit fighting about reform. You should be for reform. The devil's in the details. But we should be for constantly improving quality of training, constantly improving our social networking skills, bringing in people who are professionals in mental health. We should be for those things. But when we resist even the simplest changes, well, we've got enough training. People don't understand. No, they do understand. And they're willing to pay. And if you got to go sit in a classroom for 40 dang hours because they want you to go through that school again, well, go sit in a dang classroom for 40 hours. You're making $100,000 a year. It's well worth it. I don't think that policing is over. All this is coming. It's not going to ever be the same. No, it's not going to be the same. It's not over. Young men and women are still showing up and not in the numbers that we need, but that drives the wages up. So I think it will work out. We're in a very, very evolutionary or even revolutionary period, but it's going to be okay. But we got to be smart, and we have to accept those things that we cannot change. And we've got to go in and be smart about what we do, and we can make the wages for that. The public, I think, is more educated and attuned to what they want out of their police than they've ever been.
Ron, I want to build on what you just talked about, and I want to use Chicago as a metaphor. You're not representing anybody in Chicago, are you? I don't want to put you in a bind here.
No, never.
Okay.
No, never.
It's a lovely city. I actually I love Chicago.
I like Chicago. It's got its problems.
So let's say you're the FOP represents rank and file police officers in Chicago right now. And let's say you're brought in as a consultant to the FOP. And here's what's on their plate. And I'm just going from news stories here.
Sure.
So they have a police chief who asked where recording this was fired yesterday or day before yesterday for what appears to be a videotape that is inconsistent with his public statements about why he was found passed out behind the wheel of a city-owned vehicle in the middle of the night in Chicago. So we got a police chief who got fired.
Yeah.
We have a district attorney that the police union has opposed who is running for re-election. Mm-hmm. You have a brand spanking new consent decree, the first in the country that was the product of a state attorney general's initiative rather than the federal government, a consent decree that the rank and file union opposed, tried to intervene and was told they had intervened too late. You have a collective bargaining agreement that has expired 2.5 years ago with no, at least public signs of any progress towards a new agreement. You have a mayor that they opposed in the election process, and there's been some very public sniping back and forth between the mayor and the police union. Again, as we're recording this just a couple of days ago, the mayor was heard to make a very negative statement about a union executive board member when she didn't know her microphone was hot in a public setting. You've got what appears to be this huge conflict between members of the public and the police union that's spinning out in public discussions at all times. It's really, I think, the most challenging major city police problem in this country right now. I'd even put it higher than NYPD. So you're the consultant. You're coming in. You're getting the big bucks. Well, you're from Texas, so they're not going to be as big bucks as someone from Oregon, but you're getting the big bucks to come in there.
That's right.
Yeah, that's as it should be, Ron.
And
what do you tell them? You're going to say to them something like, "Look, guys, you got to follow this 3-point plan or 5-point plan or 10-point plan, whatever it is. What advice are you going to give them? And before you answer that, I'm just using them as a metaphor, because police unions all over the country are facing pieces of this. And they will be facing, or may be facing, the sort of ballot measures that you have been talking about. They're facing the recruitment and retention problems you're talking about. So this is just really a metaphor for your advice to the country. So all yours.
Yeah. And I don't know all the insight, and I never publicly criticize any union leader, police union leader, because I'm not standing there with a crowd full of people screaming at me to fix a problem. Now, I'll use a generic form, because I'm actually working for a police department, a union outside of Texas. Very dysfunctional position. The contract had not been renewed in 2 years. Outside chief came in, lots of racial stress, a very controversial shooting, and all of this. And the union, everything was a war. And the union asked me to come in, and I went, and I've been fiddling with it for a year. I'm almost done. But when I first sat down with them, I listened to everything they had to say, and I said, is what you're doing working? They said, well, no. I said, well, your contract's run out. It's just in place, but you haven't had a raise since 2016. I said, we're going to approach this totally different, and I want you to do these things. And I wanted, and I started, I had them go out and meet with a local community group that was African-American, and go start talking to them about what they thought needed to be done. I had them go sit down with the chief, even though they can't stand each other, and start having a conversation of what his vision was for the deal. I had a meeting with the mayor in a group and the top people, and I listened to the things that she said. I went back and I read through all the newspaper articles, looking for the key points. And this is kind of, in a simplified form, what I told them to do. All of these things that the mayor thinks would be a win for her, the chief thinks is a win, but the members won't, those things are not all incompatible. And I want you to start thinking differently than you thought before. And also there, the board and the union, the department has got a lot of minorities, but they were not active on the union yet. I had them go and told them, I'm not going to the table without African-Americans on the team. Go out and find some people that are, you know, they're willing to work hard for the union and the department, and they did. I said, we're not going to show up with an all-white, male, older, veteran board. We're going to come in new. And we're not going to start off with a battle. And so once I figured out what the mayor wanted, I walked in and I said, what is it that she wants that you really think is that bad? And I said, and what does the chief want here? Now, you don't have to like him. He won't stay forever. None of them do. But he actually wants some things. What can we give to him where he feels that he's got to win? And then what do we need to have a win? And once I started getting that and I got them to the table, I just got the union to quit just being against it, because they hate the mayor and they didn't support her. They didn't support the chief. And we slowly have just kind of built this relationship. It's a smaller department, 600 or 700 officers. But the principles are the same. Now, complex, if you're dealing with Chicago, but they've got to have some place of where they can have a conversation. What is it that the mayor wants that you can live with? And what does the chief want? What does the public want? So, and what do the activists want? You see, and I know this is very simplified. It's far more complex than this, but you then have all the social ills of Chicago. The union might want to start building a relationship. They don't have, and I'm not picking on them, all the major city unions have few relationships with any of the community groups. A lot of them don't. And I told them, go start meeting with these groups. They want a better police department. They want a better city. And if you embrace the concept of reform, you embrace that we need quality people, we need training, we need professionals, and we need help. We need help from the state and federal government, the city, to deal with the poverty and the crime in Chicago, and let us focus on that. Then you can start looking for those little links that will start tying together. I use this term, and I don't say it publicly, I'll say it here. You have to set the hook. If you go to the table and you just want, and you don't care what they want, the hook will never get set. It's when the other side believes that they're going to get some things that they want, that they're willing to listen to the things that you want. So I tell the group, when we get everybody in line and concentrate on what they need to have a winning contract, then I tell them, let's say we'll do those things. Anyway, that may be too simplified for you. And like I said, if I flew to Chicago tomorrow, it might take 6 months or a year to get everybody focused. But what they're doing now on both sides is not working. It's not working from the past two mayors, and it's not working for the union.
Ron, I have a little bit of a guilty confession here. You know, I've spent most of my career practicing in the Pacific Northwest, where we have binding arbitration as the last step in the bargaining process. We're not in a meet and confer setting. And when I started practicing, and I started practicing long time ago, when I started practicing, I looked at the binding arbitration statutes, and I was like a kid with a toy box. I thought these things were wonderful, you know, that here you have a whole bunch of criteria, the cost of living and total compensation and all that sort of stuff. You have a bunch of criteria. They're pretty objective. You can go out and attach numbers to them. You can analyze them and you can present them. And it's a way of getting a neutral third party's take on what your wages and benefits should be. And I thought that was the be-all and end-all of how to accomplish the best results for members. I don't think that anymore. And I stopped thinking that many years ago. I mean, I do think binding arbitration is important. I think it's necessary for those occasions when things go badly wrong. But I think the greatest successes in bargaining are achieved by police unions when they have relationships. You use that word. I want to expand it a little bit. When they have relationships with elected officials, with the mayor, with city council members. I tell my clients, if you're not meeting with every city council member on a periodic basis for coffee, you're missing a bet. You need to be talking to them. Don't ask for anything when you talk to them. Listen to them as to what they have to say. You need relationships with the business community. You need to be joining the Chamber of Commerce, even if the Chamber of Commerce is something that you might think is antithetical to your basic union values. You need to be joining them. You need to be out there talking to community groups. You may have, for example, a neighborhood associations. You need to be appearing before them and discussing with them. You need to be engaging with the activist groups to the extent they're willing to sit down with you and talking with you. It's only through those relationships that you are going to end up accomplishing what every police union wants to accomplish, the best wages, hours, and working conditions for their members. Sure, you got to be able to beat them over the head with a stick in binding arbitration from time to time. If you've got that as a last resort, you got to be able to do that. You got to put up the good fight. But it's better to avoid the good fight in almost every circumstance. So that's my somewhat guilty confession about that.
Well, I agree with you 100%. We never had it here. And there were some chances where we might have been able to get it. And I'll tell you, there are days of when I'm bargaining, it drags on and it's getting tense, that I wish I could just stop and go to arbitration. But here's the way I see it. Today, particularly in the complexities of policing and the amount of money being spent on the police, not just wages and benefits, but training, equipment, I mean, it's expensive. But I want the union and I want the employer to figure this out at the table and mutually walk off that this is the best deal we can do. And when either side knows, is afraid, the union president looks and goes, we ought to take this deal, everybody will be happy. And then some member says, well, let's go to arbitration, we might get more. Or the city manager brings it back to the council and they go, oh, yeah, but let's just go to arbitration, maybe we'll get more. See, I don't want anyone to go anywhere. I don't care how long it lasts. They'll be pushing and shoving. There may be a little pushback or election. But in the end, when we come to a deal, particularly where I work here in Texas, we all shake hands. It's the best deal that we could get. We're forced to listen to both sides. And my views have never changed. I've never been for arbitration. But the way I used to start with confrontation, and now I only use it if I have to. They have to know we will do it. But I am putting more and more pressure. When I sit down with a group, the first question I ask the group, they'll give me a list of stuff they want. And I'll ask them this: how many votes do you have on the council to get this item? If they can't tell me that, then they're not prepared for the game. They got to know and talk and know what the council and the mayor think is a win. You don't have to agree to all of it. But if I know what you think is a win, man, if we could just, chief could get this, or the mayor and council want the police to do this or that, and you can live with that, then accept that. But in exchange, this is what you need. And I find that process better. It's lengthier, stressful, and oftentimes dirty and nasty. But we get a deal, and we get a deal that nobody came in and made anybody take. I mean, San Antonio's last contract was 3 years. Austin was two years at the table. But you know what? We both walked off, and we have not had a lot of bad feelings left on either side.
Now, Ron, I do have to part company with you there, because – I'm still a binding arbitration fan for those situations, but rarely, only when you need to.
Yeah.
Hey, Ron, you've been really generous with your time with us, but I do want your take on a couple of national issues, if you feel comfortable doing it. First of all, last few years, we've seen a number of police boycotts out there.
Yeah.
I think most notably, there was a boycott of Nike in the wake of an ad featuring Colin Kaepernick. And, of course, there's the national comments on Kaepernick.
Sure.
In New York, you have the Detectives Endowment Association and the PBA boycotting Dunkin' Donuts. You have the Miami FOP that boycotted Beyonce's tour. I mean, there's boycotts all over the place. What's your take on that? Is that an effective strategy?
Not anymore. It depends. Now, let me say this. I'm not criticizing, and I'm not just saying this to cover myself. I'm not criticizing. Membership wanted something, the union made a decision, did it. And I was involved in the cop killer deal with Ice-T on a national level, ended up in California, got the shareholders to get rid of him. But I'll, at the time, I will also separate that someone putting out a record by an entertainment company, Time Warner, to kill the police is a separation from Colin Kaepernick or Beyonce and these others, or Dunkin' Donut. I'll give you, this will be another line that will, I'm sure I'll get a response from. Who made the police union the defender of the American flag? Who said to them that you ought to be defending the flag? I'm separating the right of an individual to believe whatever they wish. I would not be happy or want to witness someone trampling on the flag or burn it. That's me personally. But as a union, in the times of the most racially divided nation, racially divided issues among the police getting involved in these things that are really about people's right to protest their perception of police injustice and won't change, that the unions coming out and attacking mostly black people and people of color over their right to protest. See, I think the better role should be is man bites dog, not the reverse. I would have told the national unions, I would have preferred that when these issues come up, and I'm starting to see a lot of unions doing this now, go to the corporation, go to the NFL and say, we support Colin Kaepernick's right. If he believes he doesn't want to kneel, that's his business. He doesn't want to stand. But here's the deal. Put your money up and let us help figure out how to deal with this divide in the community. And not have the police proceed to be constantly over there with the far right. That may be their personal political views, but that's not the role of the police. The police are the thin blue line that stands there and lets activists and Nazis both have the right to say something while they provide law and order and respect. I just think at a time, what message does it send to the minority community when you attack Beyonce or some 16-year-old kid writes pig on your cuff? You have a right to push back. You have a right to go talk to the manager and say, we're not going to be disrespected. But do we always boycott? How thin-skinned are we? You say we're supposed to be thick-skinned people who can take it. And we come across oftentimes, I'm using very generically, unions come across as bullies, crushing, you know, these things. I think the better approach is to challenge these corporations when things happen or these events happen and say, that's great, but what are we going to do together to educate the public about the police? And what are we going to do to solve these problems? See, I'm not critical of it. I've done it myself, and I wouldn't be afraid to do it in the future. But I think we have to be smarter about it and not let what our individual members' personal beliefs are be the position of the union. You see, I don't care what they do individually, but I do think if you're constantly seeing pushing back against people who are protesting legally, then I think that creates another divide. It makes us painted as being on one side of this debate. We're in the middle of this debate. We're there for law and order. We're there to protect you. We're there to protect the Constitution. We're not there to get in those type of debates that put us on one side of the racial divide than the other. That's just my humble opinion, you know, after 50 years of looking at this.
And Ron, I want to wind up with a topic, and I will take the lead on this so both of us can get fired as a result of this podcast from every job. I want to take a lead on this. We have seen in the last few years the national police unions getting more and more involved in national politics. We saw, for example, in the 2016 election, we saw the National Fraternal Order of Police endorsement of President Trump being used very effectively, I think, by President Trump in that campaign. The National FOP has already issued one press release supporting President Trump in the impeachment inquiry. And we've also seen already in this election year, in 2019, we've seen another national police organization, the International Union of Police Associations. They already have endorsed President Trump for re-election without even knowing who his Democratic opponent is going to be. And I look at that and I've got to tell you, it all rubs me the wrong way, not because of my political views. It rubs me the wrong way just simply from the standpoint of the effective use of politics by unions. It seems to me unions can't be identified with any one political party, or they're going to lose in the end. Police unions, you can make an argument, ought to stay out of national politics entirely. Because there's not that much advantage to being involved in national politics as opposed to at the local political level. But when we're in the situation that we're in right now, where we see an identification of two major police union groups, if the FOP can accurately be called a police union, when we see this identification of these two groups that have between them, they claim about 400,000, 500,000 members with one political party, I see warning signs there. And I'm wondering if your reaction is the same.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and this is, I won't say it's two-faced of me, but I came into this business believing the right of the police unions to be involved in the political process. And I would say we weren't identified with any party per se, but in 1988, Cleat did and NAPO did endorse, in the presidential race against George Bush for Dukakis. A lot of backlash. Now, moving forward to today, I will say this. The Democratic Party is dependent heavily on African-American vote and a lot of people of color. And they want to speak to that. They're not as dependent on even private sector unions anymore. So they kind of, because of all the rhetoric and all that, they've driven a lot of police unions out of their camp on a statewide basis and local basis, and a lot of individual police officers are conservative anyway. So, and then Trump comes along, and I will say this for him. He has shown a lot of respect for the police. He goes out of his way to be respectful for the police, and in that, they felt they had a champion that they did not have under Obama and some other presidents. So, but now, there's going to be a price to pay for this, even though I don't know that there's no national police union going to endorse any Democrat for president of the United States in the current political world. It's just not going to happen. So they either have to stay out or they just pick the side. I would tell you this. They're in. They're in for Trump. Trump wins. God bless it. Trump loses. Then you do like you would do in any political process. You're going to have to go in with the Democrats and figure out how that they can get the issues they want resolved and you can live with them. But is it divisive? Yes. Does it go and create more havoc with trying to close the racial divide? Yes. But that die is already cast. So there are countries where the police are not allowed to be endorsing political candidates. They can be involved in issues. And that's probably where we should be on the national level. But that's not going to roll back. So I think it's going to have to play itself out. I don't think the FOP or NAPO or IUPA really have any choice if you were to poll their members. So that's going to play out. That's just the way it is.
Well, Ron, thanks so much for this conversation and for your perspective on all of these issues. You really have been one of the masters of your trade over the entire time that certainly I have been practicing. And there's a lot of police unions and police officers and deputy sheriffs who, whether they know it or not, owe a lot to your efforts on their behalf. So thank you so much for participating in this podcast.
Well, thank you. Hopefully we'll get everybody talking and not shouting, because I'm listening.
Folks, that's been Ron DeLord talking to us from Texas. We hope you join us in the future for another edition of the LRIS Premium Podcast Series. Just as a reminder, we have some seminars coming up in which you may be interested. Most notably, we have a seminar on how to run a public safety union. We also call it police and fire union leadership. That'll be in Las Vegas in February. You can find information on that at the LRIS.com website. With that, looking forward to having you join us for another podcast in our series. This is Will Aitchison signing off.